Good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the MFO Conversation with the Breton Fund conference call. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, you may signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. If you would like to ask a question, you may press star and then one using a touch-tone telephone. To withdraw your question, you may press star and then two. Today's event is also being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to your moderator, Mr. David Snowball. Sir, please go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Jamie. Hi, guys, and thank you for joining us for this slightly delayed start to tonight's conversation. Our conversation tonight is with Stephen Dobson, who is the manager of the Breton Fund based in San Francisco. It's one of a series of conversations we've had with the managers of funds who have exceptionally high levels of commitment to their portfolio, both a personal commitment, that is, in being highly, deeply invested in the fund, but also in constructing a portfolio that really does epitomize the notion of sticking with your best ideas. Cook and Bynum and River Park Wedgwood were the other two in this immediate series. The smallest of those funds, the smallest of those funds is the Breton Fund. It has about $6 million in assets and has about 15 stock positions. It originally came to our attention because of a long series, a long streak of months in which it was recognized by the Wall Street Journal as one of the top performing funds in existence. That occurred primarily during the turbulent market in 2011, early 2012. It is more recently, though, reasserted its place in our attention based on work done by my collaborator and associate editor, Charles Bocadoro. Charles and I share the conviction that understanding the risk characteristics of a fund are at least as important and in most ways more important than understanding its returns. Beauty, as they say, is only skin deep, but ugly goes right to the bone. And we've got that same suspicion about the performance of a fund, that a fund's flashy returns tend not to persist, but its risk profile does tend to stick with it over time. And so we have looked at the performance on a number of risk measures of mid-cap funds or of all-cap funds, and as it turns out, by a whole variety of measures, the best there is among the newer funds is Breton. And so for that reason, I was very pleased that Stephen Dobson agreed to spend a little time with us tonight. The plan is, as always, that I'd like to take about the first 15 or 20 minutes and ask Stephen if he would walk us through the fund's kind of strategy and genesis. And then after that, we'll take 15 minutes or so in order to ask some questions and then open the phone lines up to you folks at the end. As we get closer to the point where we're inviting your participation, we'll go over again the procedure for doing that. But for now, I'd like to welcome Stephen, thank him for his time, and let him have the floor.
Well, thank you, David. Appreciate the introduction and appreciate the opportunity to be here. And thanks to everybody who was able to make it on the call today. First, I'll give a little background on my career. I got an undergraduate degree from in business from Berkeley, and afterwards I went to work as a junior investment banker in New York and later Menlo Park, working for Morgan Stanley and the 80 to 100-hour a week jobs, taking telecom companies public, issuing public debt. It's a great place to learn. Wall Street's a wonderful place to sort of get your bearings of the industry, but it's not a probably phenomenal place to be for long term. And afterwards, I worked in venture capital, investing in software companies and communications companies, and eventually found my way back to my father's firm. My father is Jerry Dodson. He founded a firm called Parnassus Investments, which I'm guessing at least some callers, some listeners here will know is a mid-sized mutual fund firm here in San Francisco, where I'm based right now. And when I joined Parnassus, I essentially worked in every part of the firm. I answered phones, I did the trading, did the compliance, work in accounting, equity research, portfolio management. was a co-portfolio manager of a bond fund and left the firm as president. And I'm sure I'm not the first person and nor the last person to realize that managing a family relationship and managing what I wanted in my career was incompatible at the time. So I decided to go off my own and do something smaller. And, you know, when I was thinking about what I want to do, you know, I've always been an enormous fan of Buffett. I think he's the greatest investor of all time. And I think most mutual fund shareholders, most mutual fund managers would consider him the greatest investor of all time. But almost nobody actually invests like him. He's made it, you know, Buffett's made it very explicit about how he invests. He finds a small number of good businesses that he believes he understands and that are trading for a significant discount to what he believes what they're worth. He does not, you know, create style boxes. He does not sort of track the index. He doesn't invest in sectors that he doesn't understand just because they're in the index. He sort of just focuses on a handful of good businesses. And, you know, you could describe this way of investing as concentrated long-term value. I mean, it's a very, very simple, simple to describe approach. But if you were to make a list of all the mutual funds out there that take that same approach, you probably wouldn't get to 20. And for callers that have been, for listeners that have been on the call before, I think Cook and Bynum is definitely a fund I would put in that same category of concentrated long-term value. And, you know, it's sort of shocking to me that here you have, you know, Warren Buffett, the greatest investor of all time, and it's very clear that he's the best investor of all time and very clear strategy, but you can't even get to, not even a couple dozen people are taking his approach. And, you know, this is somewhat rational from mutual funds standpoint. You know, the Buffett approach is great for mutual fund shareholders over the long run, but they're not always good asset gathering machines. They're not very good at gathering large assets over time. And if you know, institutional investors want style boxes, they want sort of accepted standard deviation, they want you being fully invested at all times. And that sort of approach is just incompatible with the Buffett approach. And so, you know, I wanted to create a fund that would follow in the sort of the Buffett footsteps and do this approach. Now, I did think about starting a hedge fund. I have lots of friends in the financial services industry and fellow investors, and pretty much everybody that I know that's sort of investing entrepreneur starts a hedge fund. And then the problem with that is there are a ton of hedge funds out there that invest with this concentrated value approach, and but they're really only a handful of mutual funds. So I saw this as an opportunity to do something in this space, and you know, I'm also much more enamored with I'd much rather have a career doing something for the average investor than help the ultra wealthy get ultra wealthier. Now, I want to talk a little bit about sort of the second premise of the fund. You know, the first is I try to manage how Buffett would run the fund. The second thing is I try to be more shareholder centric than the average fund. So the Breton Fund has no soft dollars, no 12b1 fees, no loads. There will never be another Breton Fund. There will never be a Breton Small Cap Fund or Breton International Fund. It's one fund full of my best ideas. And you know, as David mentioned, the fund has a substantial backing from myself, my family. Majority of my net worth is invested in the fund. I prohibited myself from owning outside stocks. And one of the reasons I did that was, I'd ask, you know, both our portfolio managers who ran sort of these institutional class funds that have 50, 100 holdings and weighted to the S&P 500 and look for a certain percentage of healthcare stocks, certain percentage of energy stocks, what have you. I would ask them, you know, how would you invest if it was only your money and you know, you never had to report out to outside shareholders, but you needed to sort of protect and grow this capital at an attractive rate for the rest of your life. How would you invest? And you know, would you invest in the same approach, 50 to 100 stocks across all sectors? They said, absolutely not. You know, I'd probably only invest my 10 to 20 ideas. And this this contradiction really struck me, and I wanted to avoid doing that. And so, you know, I've invested all my net worth, all my investable net worth, pretty much all my non-cash net worth is in the fund itself. All my family members are invested in the fund. My mother is invested in the fund. My mother-in-law is invested in the fund, and that definitely sharpens the mind. I also want to talk a bit about how I actually how I invest. And so, like I said before, the driving principle behind the strategy is very simple. It's I look for businesses that are trading much less than they're worth, and that's the traditional value strategy, not the necessary Morningstar definition of value, but the Buffett definition of value. And the tricky part is figuring out exactly what a company is worth. The vast majority of businesses out there, I really don't have a good idea what they'll look 5-10 years from now. So I stick to companies that I do believe I'll know what they'll look like 5-10 years from now. And my approach is to sort of cast a very, very wide net, but draw my circle of competence very, very small. And I think I think one of the most underrated aspects of successful investing is being almost fanatic about sticking to what you know. And I think that's one of the most important competitive advantages I have is essentially drawing my circle of competence smaller than the other guys. I try to wait for the no-brainers. And second thing is just having a longer time perspective. You know, I think most people are well aware that people look to calendar year, people look to year to date, but if you really care about the 5 years down the line, I think that's a pretty that can be a pretty enormous advantage. A litmus test for me about whether I understand a company is, do I understand what prices will be like 5 years from now? And I think if you're investing, you know, that's a good question to ask yourself. excuse me. If you think of, say, oil prices, you know, they think they peaked at, you know, $130 recently or within the past 5-6 years, and they troughed at $40. And then 5 years from now, some of the smartest people I know, some of the smartest energy experts that I know, think oil will be at $50. Some of the smartest oil investors I know think oil will be at $150. And I think it's very, very hard to sort of get a feeling for what that price will be like 5-10 years from now. And, you know, what I can tell you is that a can of Coke on my street corner, my corner store cost a dollar. Now, I have a high amount of confidence that that can of Coke is going to track the rate of inflation, roughly rate of inflation over time. And that's an example of something that I feel like I can sort of stick to my knitting, something that I have a high degree of predicting. Another example is AMC Networks. AMC is a publicly traded company. They produce shows like Mad Men and produce shows like Breaking Bad, both of which I enjoy. Now, what will pricing be like 5-10 years from now in the cable business? I don't know. I don't know if cable companies are going to be around. I don't know whether we'll stream everything from Netflix or people will buy things from iTunes. And I'm not sure if a lot of people know. I'm not sure if anybody knows. And because I don't know that, I'll just pass. I think that's the most important part about investing is knowing when to pass, knowing when, even if you understand a business now, not understanding what a business will look like 5-10 years from now, I think is pretty important. And David, I don't want to check with you on time in terms of where are we, you know, how much, whether you want to go to Q&A now or whether I could talk a little bit more about stock selection.
Sure. If you've got more you wanted to share, go for it, and then we'll chat.
All right. What I do try to do is cast, like I said earlier, as wide a net as possible out there. I glance at least at, you know, almost every public company out there, and in some ways, my job is kind of like a cross between an investigative journalist and a professional gambler. And, you know, each business has its own story. It has its customers, has history, has competition, has expansion opportunities. And when I look at a company, I'm trying to understand its particular story, how it works, how it runs. My job is to understand as many stories as I can. Now, most of the stories out there are either not very interesting or they're incomprehensible, or what happens a lot of times that this story is well understood by everyone. And what I'm trying to do is find undiscovered stories or underappreciated stories. And after sifting through hundreds, sometimes thousands of companies, I can occasionally find something that's compelling that is not fully understood by the market. And, you know, when I look at businesses, I'm trying to find businesses that are, you know, relevant and defensible. And I think those, you can, in some ways, you can break down the economics of any business into relevance and defense. And as an example, you can look at a company like Kodak. Kodak made camera film, of course, and it was a highly, highly defensible product. You know, you cannot go out and create another factory and distribution network that Kodak had, but the product ceased to be relevant. And so you want to avoid businesses that are essentially going to lose relevance. That's sort of the obvious example. You know, what people always sort of forget about is you also want a business that's defensible. If you look at the trucking business versus the railroad business, they both are engaged in pretty much the same thing. They're taking boxes and moving them from point A to point B. But trucking companies, it's pretty much impossible to create a major rail company from scratch today. But with trucking companies, you know, it's pretty easy to go out and start it up. And so those businesses get sort of competed away. And so when I look at the Breton Fund, I try to find businesses that are relevant and defensible over time. And so that's sort of the ideal company I can find.
Great. Cool. Thank you. I was kind of interested if you could just kind of talk through a couple things. You talked about trying to draw your circle of competence narrower than other folks so that you were sort of sticking to things that you knew well enough that you could make really good judgments about them. So how do you define your circle of competence? What are you competent at?
It ends up being businesses, you know, I think, again, the litmus test is, do I think I'll understand how this business will be 5-10 years from now? And, you know, what that ends up being is, you know, if I look at the fund's portfolio, it's things like retail. You know, I go shopping for my wife, and I sort of pick things out, and I sort of, as a shopper, I understand how the retail markets work. And another company I recently invest in makes pesto sauce, and that's something I feel like I understand. Financial services is something that has fallen into my competence zone. Transportation is something I feel like I understand. But in its, you know, there are businesses like media I feel like I understand currently, but I'm unable to predict. You know, I think there's so much change going on in the industry that even if you can have a great grasp of how media prices are set right now, I think it's very, very hard to sort of come away with confidence saying people will pay $3 an episode for a TV show, for a quality TV show 10 years from now, or it will be ad supported at a rate of, you know, X amount of cents per viewers. And I think those are things are I just try to stay away from.
Okay. Oh, that's great. And so you talked about you've got these kind of areas where you're feeling pretty comfortable, and then you screen through companies looking for great stories. And I didn't know if you could sort of explain to me how that screening proceeds. I mean, you've talked about looking at thousands of companies, but I'm presuming you're not looking at thousands of stories, right? There has to be some sort of mass sort of statistical sweep first, or?
I'll just tell you my process is not like it's a big secret. not like people will run out and run up, you know, steal my process. There's a couple of approaches. That's right. It is impossible to understand, you know, 3,500 companies that are traded on the New York and NASDAQ and understand them deeply in any sort of meaningful way. And, you know, I do tend to focus more on companies that are, you know, I feel like are in my wheelhouse of, you know, consumer products and food and sometimes industrial goods. But there's a service called Valueline, and they publish a one-page profile of, you know, 3,500 public companies that are out there, and they'll send a profile every single stack of profiles every single week. And so after 52 weeks, they will cycle at least, you know, at least every public company has a profile being sent to you four times a year. And so I'll sit down and sort of like go through this week. I'll go through, you know, the biotech companies. Next week, I'll go through the insurance companies. Now, when it comes to biotech, that's, you know, as you may guess, is something that I have no idea what company A will get FDA approval, et cetera. So we tend to peruse those. I am looking for maybe a situation where the market cap's less than the cash on the balance sheet, things like that. But for the most part, I tend to pass those. Now, for companies that I believe are within my wheelhouse, I'll pause and I'll look at, say, Procter & Gamble and look at their multiple, look at how much their returns on capital are, what their growth rate is. And so I'm at least nodding acquaintances with, you know, most public companies out there. And if I find something compelling, you know, I'll pull it out. Example is Carter's to make baby clothes, and I had not heard of them before. And I saw, you know, going through Valueline maybe 3 years ago, I'm like, oh, this is a great company. It's has staggering growth, but it's only trading at a ratio of its price to its earnings of only about 10. Like, why is that? That's going to be an interesting story. And so I spent the next couple of weeks trying to understand Carter's and asking my friends with newborn babies whether they like Carter's clothes, and got great feedback. And it's been one of the better investments I've made. And so I try to learn new stories about one to two a day. I try to read one to two 10Ks a day. And sort of that knowledge accumulates over time.
Okay. And so you kind of read an awful lot, sort through, and then you're looking for companies that have this kind of set of criteria you've talked about in your material: ethical management, a defensible position in the market, and ones that are selling at less than they're worth. Is there a sort of measure that you typically look at to determine that they're less than they're worth, or is that different by sector? Or?
Yeah, well, very technically speaking, every company is worth just simply the present value of its earnings. Or if you want to be fancy, you can say it's the, you know, present value of its future cash flows. And what you're looking for is really, it's, you really want to understand what that business is going to earn over time. And, you know, you, because of public financials, you know what the company has earned in the past. So you have a pretty good idea of what it's earned the last, say, 12 months or so. And you can have a decent guess as to what it's going to earn the next 12 months or so. And I think for investors, you know, you want to look at a term called enterprise value, which is the market cap and the factors in the amount of debt and cash the company has, and you want to compare that to as a ratio of what the business earns pre-tax or after-tax on an operating basis. And so if you find businesses that are trading at, say, a reasonable multiple, as they say, but it's an outstanding business, that's a great situation. If you're finding, say, a so-so business at a so-so price, then you want to keep looking. If you find a so-so business at a phenomenal price, that's also interesting as well. And so the Breton Fund tends to be a combination of what I think are great businesses at good prices or okay businesses at great prices.
Okay. Now, you'd mentioned, you know, the folks at Cook and Bynum earlier, and typically they're looking for something like a discount to their valuation of the company. They would prefer 50%. They might be willing to talk about one discount at 30%. But after that, they just said it's beyond what they're comfortable with. Do you have a kind of similar sense, Stephen, about how
deep that discount needs to be in order for you to think it has enough of a margin of safety?
You know, the vast majority of value investors, or the concentrated value investors that I admire, including Cook and Bynum, think in terms of discounts to intrinsic value, and I think it's a very, very valid approach. I have a slightly different preference when it comes to how I think about it. I sort of invert the situation, or I basically look for expected returns, expected annualized returns. So there's a term in finance called internal rate of return, or IRR. And so what I look for is, you know, what percent annualized return will this investment get me? And sort of like an inversion of the same thing, basically, if you factor in discount rates, et cetera. And so a lot of it will, of course, depend on what the market is offering you. If you can find annualized returns, like in March 2009, the bottom of the market, it was you were sort of perusing 20% annualized returns or 30% annualized returns and trying to find the 40% annualized returns. And today, it's not that situation at all. Today, you're sort of like trying to avoid the negative returns, and maybe if you get lucky, you can find a business that may return sort of a 10% annualized return. So some of it is going to depend on sort of what's available. I think once you get to, once you get to double digits, that's pretty attractive. And I think, you know, very rarely you'll be able to find something high teens, low 20s. But again, that's extremely rare. And I think that'd be something I would get very, very excited about.
Right, at least given the kind of current state of the market.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, I don't think investors are being compensated at, you know, for low single-digit returns or even mid-single-digit returns. But I think sort of once you get to teens, it starts getting pretty interesting.
And are you seeing many companies that meet that criteria now? I mean, I know investors are anxious about the current state of the market that way.
You know, I wish I was. I really wish there were more out there. I think they're only, a lot of my holdings are sort of in hold mode, and sort of these are businesses that I thought were, you know, high teens, low 20s type returns, and the market has run up so much to sort of knock down their prices to sort of either low teens or high single digits. So I think in terms of businesses that I think, or investment opportunities at least that I see, that are potentially, at attractive rates, and I don't want to get too specific into saying, you know, company X is going to guarantee a X percent return or anything like that. But I think there are, you know, a number of my top holdings, and I believe are in sort of that attractive zone out there. But it's extremely, extremely hard to find attractive investments these days, and that's something I spend my days doing, is looking for opportunities present themselves. You know, the market doesn't have to necessarily go down 20% before you start finding more, but you just need a handful of companies to maybe have a stumble or two, or bad earnings miss, and then that presents a great opportunity. And then if you have a concentrated approach, you don't need to find 50 businesses that are deeply undervalued. You only need to find, you know, a dozen or so.
Right. I was going to ask you another question, if I could, about the cash stake in the fund, because it kind of ties to that discussion. But before I do, I thought I would check in with Jamie and ask if he would go over with folks what the strategy is for asking a question, if they had one.
Sure. If anyone would like to ask a question, please press star and then one using a touch-tone telephone. To withdraw your question, you may press star and then two. Again, it is star and then one to ask a question.
Great. Thank you, Jamie. It's harder and harder to find good values. The last published report, the fund was sitting at about 18% cash.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You'd mentioned that your intention was to maintain what I think you'd refer to as a moderate cash balance in order not just to meet the operating expenses of the fund, redemptions and that sort of thing, but also to be able to sort of move in on good opportunities. I was kind of wondering what moderate translates to for you. Like if you were to think in a pretty good market, pretty good for you, a place where there are, you know, a fair number of values out there, how much cash are you apt to be holding, do you suppose?
You know, it's a tough question to answer. I'd say, you know, right now the fund is in that 15 to 20% range, and my guess is that in a, you know, moderately highly valued market, that's what the fund will look like. But again, so much of it depends on what's out there. If the market, say, goes up by 10% and it becomes even more expensive than it is today, but I find 3-4 phenomenal ideas, the fund would have, you know, I'd have no problem fully investing the fund. It's sort of like very company specific, but it's just so hard to find these, you know, I call them cheap compounders, right? Businesses that are going to be growing every single year. This year they're worth a dollar, next year they're worth $1.20, the year after that they're worth $1.30. And those are kind of the ideal companies you can find, but they're really, you know, most of them are priced to perfection, and it's only a handful of them out there that I believe are relatively cheap. And so if I could find 3-4, I'd have, you know, I'd be 100% invested at this point, but it's just a struggle to find that amount. But to answer your question directly, I'd say that, yeah, I think where the fund is now is a moderate amount of cash.
Okay. And so you might become fully invested. You might go down to 3-4% cash if you saw a repeat of something like the March 2009 market, where almost anywhere you looked, there were companies that were badly undervalued. But other than that, somewhere in the teens, somewhere toward 20 would feel like a comfortable buffer for you?
You know, I'd ideally like to put, I mean, especially with the fund so small, I ideally, you know, I feel like I really should be fully invested at this asset size. I just don't want to be putting capital at risk in mediocre investments. I'd broaden. I'd say 10 to 20%. In a, you know, moderately highly valued market is where I expect the fund to be. In a March 2009 scenario, the fund's going to be 100% invested. Like you said, maybe a couple percentage points here and there to manage redemptions and things like that. But for the most part, I think those are rare opportunities that come up, and so ideally the fund would try to take advantage of those situations to the best it could.
Oh, great. Jamie, did we have a question on the line?
We actually have a few. Our first question comes from Frank Nobles. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes. What is the minimum size that you need to have in your fund to be sustainable in assets? And then the second part of it is there some maximum level in the amount of assets in your fund that you feel like you can manage?
Great questions. And the minimum, the fund's $6 million now. In order to cover the hard cost of the fund needs to be $7 million. And you know, one thing I wanted to mention earlier in the call but forgot to is, you know, I'm sort of, this is almost like a family office for me and my family in some ways. This is sort of be the primary vehicle for the fund and for the preservation growth of my personal assets over the long run. So there's enough. I have enough cash to sort of keep the run going indefinitely, so to speak. But in terms of covering hard cost for the fund, it's $7 million, which I expect to, unless the market tanks 20%, I expect to reach that point, that dollar amount by the end of the year. I guess $20 million would be comfortable. That would be sort of be the point where the funds would be able to sort of cover more than my hard cost, so to speak, and cover my rents and groceries, bills, and things like that. Now, on the
doubled in the last year. I mean, as I looked back at the profile, the Observer wrote of you when we profiled you in early 2012, you were at about $3 million.
Yeah, so the fund has doubled, and you know, I'm continuing to get more commitments for money. Now, I will note that I'm doing zero marketing, I guess with the exception of maybe this call and calls like things like that, but I'm not You know, I don't have a marketing person hustling, trying to shake out trees. My approach has been, you know, I want to focus on the investing side of the fund. I want to focus on the returns. I want to focus on creating a great vehicle for shareholders. And if I can put together a long track record, and I have enough runway to be able to do that, I can market at that point in time. But the fund is, you know, at the core of the fund will be investing and not marketing. And in terms of the upper size, you know, that's a high class problem to have, especially with a fund that only has $6 million under management. The fund will definitely be capped, or if it reaches a certain size, I'm not quite sure what exactly that size is yet. You know, once I start, you know, seeing great ideas, but I'm unable to get enough, that's when I start seriously considering capping it. And, you know, I really don't know whether that's, you know, my guess is that you know, at least $500 million, but it could be, you know, could be a billion or two. I just don't know. But again, it's at $6 million. I'm so far away that it's a little irrelevant right now. But I do hear you that the fund needs to be capped at a certain point if assets come in.
Hi, Frank. Does that work for you, bud? Are you still there?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Sure.
And we have an additional question. This comes from Denny Barron. Please go ahead with your question.
Yeah, hi, Stephen. How are you doing today?
Hi, Denny. How are you?
I'm doing well. Are you saying then that the assets that you plan to accumulate in the future are going to be, you hope, from performance? Or are you looking at certain specific kinds of contributors to get the assets under management higher?
You know, I definitely want the assets under management to be higher, but I'm under no pressure to do so, if that makes sense. So it's not like, you know, if I don't, there is no scenario where if I don't reach, you know, X amount of dollars within Y amount of years, then I won't be able to manage the fund. No, there's enough there, so to speak, to keep the fund running as for, you know, indefinitely, basically. And, you know, I don't know if this was your question, but in terms of how, you know, my net worth as it relates to the fund, I definitely want to make some money off the fund, of course, for providing a service that the fund does. But I don't know if that number will be more than the money I make from investing in the fund. I think over the next 10, 20 years, it could easily be.
Right, Stephen? I think Denny was perhaps asking about whether you were thinking about reaching out to the advisor community as the kind of primary channel for inflows, or if you saw it as a retail vehicle. Is that closer, Denny?
That's correct. Right.
Okay, that's you know, I don't quite know who the target market is. I have worked with RIAs and financial advisors before my previous capacity. Now there's some financial advisors that are looking for very cookie cutter funds that, you know, so I want a mid cap value fund, I want a large cap growth fund that, you know, it's 100% invested at all times, that meets all this criteria, that looks like the indices, doesn't have a low standard deviation, low tracking error. I think for those advisors, this fund is just doesn't make any sense. But for advisors that, you know, like to invest in the Sequoia fund or the ACRI focus fund, I think this would be sort of a target market for them. But the fund isn't quite 3 years yet, and so the marketing towards those advisors is, you know, basically hasn't started at this point. But I do eventually believe the fund will be a mix of retail investors and financial advisors. I just don't know exactly what the mix is. Well, there's 50-50, 70-30 one way. It's really for anybody that wants a attractive vehicle for the long run.
Hey, Denny, could you tell us a bit more about the question? What were you thinking, sir? Because it's an unusual question to be for one of the calls.
Well, I think the first questioner is the one who stated the first question I had, But, you know, we see a number of funds liquidating.
Right.
And I have followed Breton ever since I heard about you, David,
mm-hmm.
putting it in the Observer newsletter, which was, well, it doesn't really matter now, but I followed it very, very closely. And I'm just interested in survivorship
mm-hmm.
and making sure that it's a going concern before I would invest my own money in it.
Oh, right. So it's more an issue that if there's a risk that Stephen would have to close the fund just because, you know, he was bleeding assets, it had become less attractive. But if even small, if it's sustainable, that might make
Correct.
It more right.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
go ahead, David.
Well,
we'll say that most of the, you know, most of the money in the fund now is essentially my money and family money, and a lot of the assets in there are sort of close friends and family, and there may be a dozen, two dozen of outside shareholders that I'm essentially I'm building this for the long haul. This is not something where, you know, there's a the massive outflow will not kill the Breton Fund, and you know there's a you know
you make your mother-in-law really angry with you
right or my mom very angry she just owns me. There is, you know, again, I know this is a public call, and so it's, I don't want to raise any ire with the SEC by saying, you know, no risk. I'll never say that, of course, but I'll say there is, I don't foresee a short-term scenario which would cause me to liquidate the fund. I mean, this is just, you know, really seeing this as a vehicle to compound my own assets. And, you know, I'm no rush to go out and raise assets to get to a sustainable level. The fund is very close to on a hard cost basis, being a sustainable amount. And that's something where, you know, I feel good about, and I don't feel a need to sort of go out and raise money quickly. You know, I don't foresee a scenario where the fund winds down in the short run.
You know, as a kind of matter of social commentary too, Denny, I've talked to a bunch of managers lately who have said almost the same thing Stephen did, which is they've made money, they're running the fund for themselves, they'd be happy to have you along, but frankly, they could run the fund forever just for themselves. I was talking to the folks with the Oakseed Fund. Just said, nope, we're not going to do marketing. We hated it. We had to do it before. We hated it. We've got enough money. And if you want to join in, we'd be so happy to have you there. But we're not going to come and find you. And Cook and Bynum pretty much said the same thing. We made a lot of money, and we're just kind of sick to death of the rat race and of chasing around. And so I get the sense that those are folks who are going to be there. Just they're probably not going to be in, you know, running a half-page ad in Barron's.
Right, that's right.
Great. Does that help, Denny?
Fair enough. We can certainly move on. Thanks for the detailed answer there, Stephen.
Great.
Sure thing, Denny.
Other folks?
Our next question comes from Alan Booth. Please go ahead with your question.
Two questions. First one's a short one. I'm assuming from the previous answers that you've given that you're really not planning on seriously having your fund marketed through the major brokerage homes.
You know, that's sort of a Faustian bargain, so to speak, right? It's sort of, you know, I even have, like, really close friends of mine, like buddies I've known for 10-plus years say, oh, I'd invest with you if you were only on Fidelity. And I said, you know what, I'm not going to be on Fidelity. And they said, okay, well, I can't invest with you. And so it's been an extremely frustrating process. The fund is on E-Trade right now, and there's a smattering of investors that are on there through E-Trade. You know, what I can tell you for sure is that the fund, at least to, you know, what's under my control, the fund will never be on the no transaction fee platform. You know, I think I've been in the industry long enough and have seen what that does to various funds. And I think that is, you know, I think it's pretty destructive, especially with a strategy that looks very different from the market. You know, with the market's up 30% and the Breton Fund's only up 10% in a given year, you could have a lot of investors take their money out, and they'll require the fund to sell shares and generate taxable events for shareholders. And I think that's very disruptive. I've seen that firsthand, and I've seen it happen to Fairholme Fund. I think we've all seen that to Fairholme, and that's sort of a imagine a very distracting thing for the company. So the fund will never be on an NTF platform or no transaction fee platform, as far as I can help it. Now, will it be on various platforms? Like, it's on Pershing right now, and so it will some brokers be able to access it? Sure, but the open question is just how much, and I don't know yet how much the funds will be on those platforms, but the fund, will not pay for distribution fees and, 40 basis points, et cetera. That's not the strategy of the fund.
Fair enough. Second question is, you go from, you have multiple caps in the fund. You have large companies like Wells Fargo where it's hard to imagine that you could know more than the market knows as far as getting into a fund like that, even though Warren is in it. But you also have some extremely micro caps like the Armiano and the and the New Resources Bank, where it's a significant percentage of your fund. And I'm actually wondering if you're controlling interest in either one of those with as a micro cap as they are. And if you worry about something that small, even though it looks like one of them you can go around the block and talk to the people, and the other one's just across the water to talk to, and you can go to the local Whole Foods to see how their pesto sauce is doing. But wondered if you worry about those as far as percentage of your portfolio and that they are so micro-cap.
I do look at it. And so, you picked out the two micro-cap companies in the fund right now. One's New Resource Bank, which might be one of the smallest banks in San Francisco, and I'm also invested in Wells Fargo, which is one of the largest, or actually the largest bank in San Francisco.
Right.
And just sort of, I think that shows that I'm agnostic to cap size. I'm careful about it, right? For the smaller companies, I am looking at liquidity and figuring out, hey, if this is something that takes a very long time to build up and the fund grows, I may be able to kind of retain as much of the company as I'd like. But I'm not highly sensitive to that, especially given the very stable shareholder base. I think it's an opportunity to invest in companies that are not as highly liquid, companies that are not as obvious. And I think Armanino, the pesto sauce company you mentioned that recently invested in, is a wonderful company. And if it was a little bit larger in an index, I think it would trade at twice the value that it is today. But it's not. And that's a great opportunity. And I don't mind holding Armanino for years and years or never selling it. I think it's as long as they're growing and returning capital to shareholders over time.
Your Nebraska Furniture Mart, huh?
Yeah, exactly. It's my Nebraska Furniture Mart, and they've got a 4.5% dividend yield, and that's in this environment, I'm very, very happy to sit on that and clip coupons and have the check sent to my office in San Francisco, or if I was Warren Buffett in this Nebraska Furniture Mart in Omaha, and collect those dividends. And so, I'm very happy to take those, and I think those are hard to find, and those kind of come up infrequently. And the vast majority of quote unquote microcap companies are sort of, a little inscrutable and, sort of tenuous business models. And I think those are more challenging, but occasionally you can find a great business that's shareholder centric and that's just, no one knows about. And those are investments I can get excited about. To answer your sort of the first part of your question around Wells Fargo, that's right. I don't think I have information that other people do not have on Wells Fargo, but I don't know if that's necessary. Some of the best investments I've made have been companies that are, relatively large and liquid and well known. But people just for whatever reason, a lot of times it's sort of time horizon. People just don't say, I can't own that quote unquote name now. I don't know how it's going to trade the next year, but I've I have a high degree of confidence that about years from now, Wells Fargo will have one of the lowest cost deposit bases, that they'll continue to collect. You know, half the revenue comes from recurring revenue and fees, and the other half comes from their loan book, and their that interest margin will be in the neighborhood of 3-3.5%, and that's a very, very attractive business model. And so, but a lot of people are so burned, and you know, they want to quote unquote underweight financials at this point. And to me, that's a great opportunity for the fund, because I don't care how Wells Fargo does over the next 12 months in terms of the stock price. I care very much how the business will earn and look like 5-10 years from now.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
And our next question comes from Paul Bellows. Please go with your question.
Yeah, I wonder if you might comment on, sort of following the last question, your understanding of J.P. Morgan. Jamie Dimon didn't fully understand it, and I guess, you know, one of my concerns has always been, how do you really know what's going on at a bank like J.P. Morgan?
Well, it's a great question, a question I get a lot, and, you know, I think the point is very valid in that I do not know more about J.P. Morgan and Jamie Dimon, and Jamie Dimon arguably did not know enough about J.P. Morgan. So, by the power of transitivity, how can I know more than know enough to know about J.P. Morgan? And you know, J.P. Morgan, there are a couple of pretty strong mitigating factors. You know, like Wells Fargo, they have significant book of business in their asset management business. So they collect a certain percentage of fees on all the business they manage. They have a pretty stable charge of fees for treasury services. They have, you know, they charge for wires and deposits, et cetera. And that's a pretty predictable business. And I think people forget that that's a huge part of J.P. Morgan's business is pretty pretty stable cash flow business. The other half of it, or to say their other parts of it, are they're essentially their loan book. And you know, if you are comfortable with where they are marking their loans at, whether you know the delinquencies have gone down for the past, I think it's 8 or 10 quarters or something like that, and it's a pretty good sign that they're past the worst of the financial crisis, that they're not going to be able to force to raise capital. And a lot of it is based on just risk reward ratio. There is so much cash in these other businesses that is being produced and going to J.P. Morgan, and so much of that cash is being returned to shareholders, that at a certain dollar amount or a certain price per share for J.P. Morgan, that's a pretty attractive risk reward ratio. Now, if you know, would I buy J.P. Morgan at a full multiple, so to speak, or at a very high price? No, I don't think I'd be very interested in that. But I think J.P. Morgan is so, you know, in other ways, other than the London Whale fiasco, or even factoring that in, I think they're such a highly competent management team. I would not make the same bet on, say, Bank of America or Citigroup. They just don't have that same history of being very careful about shareholder capital, be careful about the marks they're taking on their books. And I think J.P. Morgan is sort of a special situation where the stock price at which the fund acquired its shares are so cheap that I think it made up for some of the sort of a trading, sort of black box issues of J.P. Morgan, which I am not wild about, of course.
Thank you.
Sure.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one.
And we're very close to the top of the hour, and so I'll hang out for a minute to see if other folks do have questions. While we're kind of waiting for that, I did want to ask Stephen about new positions in the fund. As you initiate positions, you've started two new positions lately, one coach. Seems to have more than twice as much money as, is it Armanino?
Armanino.
Armanino, sorry. Pesto guy. One was an 8% position, one was 3. And I was wondering kind of how you determine how much to put behind one or another of those. Is it their market cap or?
Well, it's a combination of things, and then the most important part is what I'm most excited about. Mm-hmm. I think I am more excited about Coach Narmanino. I think it has, Coach has an enormous expansion possibilities in China. You know, they've shown to be very strong at expanding internationally, especially in Asia. They're very, very popular in Japan, Korea, Singapore, et cetera, and they're just getting started in China. So even if the U.S. business falters or stagnates, the price at which Coach is trading at makes it very, very attractive. And that was, to me, was the main reason. The other reason is mutual funds have, for lack of a better word, sort of odd diversification rules, mm-hmm. and they're mandated by the IRS, not the SEC, but you can think of a mutual fund, you can divide it into two buckets. There's the diversified half, and the concentrated half. In the concentrated half, your position limits are 25%. So in theory, you can have two positions at 25% each, or say five positions at 10% each. Mm-hmm. In the diversified half of the fund, and the Breton Fund is non-diversified, so this applies to all concentrated mutual funds, diversified half are limited to 5% positions. And so you cannot have, you have to have, in order to have a fully invested portfolio, you have to have at least 10 positions of 5%, 5% each, can't go over 5. And so some of that was the portfolio management. Sorry, what was that, David?
The attempt to stay out of jail. You don't want to kind of annoy
them. Yeah. It's not jail. It just sort of triggers an unpleasant taxable event for fund shareholders. But, I didn't have, so I have to find a lot of, sub 5% positions, and that's where, that's sort of the pressure on the fund right now, where there's plenty of, the 50% concentrated side has been relatively, or it's easier to find to fill up that side, and the diversified side is harder to find new positions, and Armanino fit sort of the bill of a sub 5% position.
Okay. Jamie, was there anyone else on the line?
Gentlemen, at this time, I'm showing no questions.
Then we should probably draw our evening to a close. I wanted to thank all of you for joining us tonight and for your questions. As always, there will be an MP3 version of this posted at the Observer on the first of the month. There will be a kind of highlights of the call posted at that same time, and we'll try to update our profile of Stephen's Fund. Shortly thereafter, we'll have an audio version of the profile as well for those of you who want to take us to the gym on your iPod. In the month ahead, I'm hopeful of having another conference call, this one live from the Morningstar conference, which I'll be attending in the middle of this month, and I'm kind of negotiating now with a management team to see if they'd be able to join me at the conference site, and I'll surely let folks know as soon as I can. And then finally, I wanted to thank Stephen for being generous with his time and for sharing both his insights about the fund and part of his day with us. Thank you, sir. I really do appreciate that.
Thank you, David. And thanks, everyone, for who's on the call and everyone who asked questions.
Great. And thank you, Jamie. Take care, everyone. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conference call. We do thank you for attending. You may now disconnect your telephone lines.